It's Wednesday, the 8th of October. This is your Biz News Briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. Now, in today's show, we deep dive into the implications of land expropriation in South Africa. We also look at the Bitcoin boom and ask whether you have missed the boat. The Joburg mining indaba is in full swing. We hear from Alec, who's on the ground. And on the international front, Tesla's bringing in cheaper models. And we also hear why gold should be in your investment portfolio. First up, Sakalixa CEO Piet le Roux and Executive Director Russell Lamberti assess the reality of land expropriation. Let's dip into their conversation on Sakalixa's YouTube platform.
We recently helped break a very important story, which has traveled far and wide and garnered a lot of attention, and it is around land expropriation. We are very involved in countering the Expropriation Act. This particular act of expropriation took place first in 2019 in a piece of ground in Boksburg, which is Johannesburg East, the east of Johannesburg in the metro of Ekurhuleni. This has garnered a lot of attention. Pete, why is this so important and why are we involved in this story, even if we're not involved in the actual case itself? And how does it pertain to our litigation? I think we need to unpack this for people to really give clarity on what's a crucial issue of expropriation.
Well, what's at stake, Russell, is whether expropriation in South Africa will happen at market value or not. In the case of Ekurhuleni, the city council took a political decision and said that they want to test the constitutional application of the property rights clause in the constitution, and they want to put it to the court that there should be a compensation, zero compensation for that expropriation. Companies try to stay out of the news, and so it's for several years it was attempted to settle this amiably and in other ways, but now it's finally going to mediation and set down for an 18-day trial next year. Why it's important is if the nil compensation decision is not reversed, we're looking at the restatement of assets on balance sheets across the country for development companies, for privately held land, all land that could conceivably also be expropriated in the public interest or for social housing, would have to be reassessed. And that means something for the balance sheets of every business and private people, pension funds, everybody in the country. It's very important, so that's why we're looking at it.
So, Pete, for context here, there was an act of Parliament passed in 1975 that essentially covered the domain of state expropriation and the circumstances under which it may or may not expropriate. That has now been superseded by the 2024 Act, although that Act has not come into full operation yet. So we're in a little bit of a transition phase. But of course, that Act is an Act that we're going to be taking on through litigation. We oppose it. We think it's harmful and leaves far too much scope for abuse. Now, a lot of people are pointing out that this case in Boksburg happened under the 1975 Act, and therefore it's not really relevant to the 2024 case. Help us discern what really is at heart in this Boksburg case. Is it the 1975 Act, or is it perhaps something a lot more core and significant, which really pertains to the Constitution? It's really a constitutional question that's up for debate. Yeah.
Absolutely, Russell, and that's why we are so interested, Sakalixa, in this case, because we will involve the facts of the Driefontein matter in our upcoming litigation against the 2024 Act. Now, this did happen under the 1975 Act, and the 1975 Act still has some protections for compensation at market value. That's part of why the owners, the former owners of Driefontein, have a good case for obtaining compensation. But in anticipation of this, in understanding that the 1975 Act is actually an obstacle to the public interest zero compensation advocates, the Ekurhuleni Metro Council has now brought a counterclaim. Not now, it's part of the proceedings. Involved. They're bringing a counterclaim to have the 1975 Act declared unconstitutional because they make a direct appeal and say they're asking the court to find that the Constitution provides for expropriation as no compensation in the public interest and that this case would qualify for that. So that's why we're bringing the facts of this matter into our expropriation 2024 litigation, because we want to show the court that the protections of the 1975 is actually necessary, and we want to show the shortcomings of the 2024 Act. If this happened under the 2024 Act, it would have been much more difficult to challenge.
Okay, so in the first instance, this case is really a test of that famous Section 25 of the Constitution.
Yes.
And whether or not it in fact permits instances of nil compensation in cases like we're seeing, where a private landowner is deprived of tens of millions of rands of value.
It's not the definitive test, but it is a test.
It is a test.
And it's a very important test. It is the most important test right now.
Yeah. And as part of this, it looks forward to our case, which is separate from this Ekurhuleni case, which tackles the Act itself, the new 2024 Act itself.
Yes.
And our claim, and you know, is that the 2024 Act strips away important protections for property owners. Some of that is being revealed in this current case, that even under the 1975 Act, and the way that the Ekurhuleni have dealt with this is potentially not sufficient protections, but certainly under the 2024 Act, too many protections have been removed.
Yeah.
South Africa's crypto landscape is undergoing a seismic shift, and at the center of it is Stafford Marcy, the executive chairman of Africa Bitcoin Corporation, known for his pioneering work with Google South Africa and his deep roots in tech innovation. Marcy is now spearheading Africa's first Bitcoin treasury strategy company. At the recent BizNews Investment Conference, Marcy reiterated his belief that Bitcoin is not just a speculative asset. It is, in his words, perfect money, a digital commodity poised to replace traditional money. Marcy's conviction runs deep. He says, Bitcoin is no longer optional. It's inevitable.
To understand Bitcoin is actually to understand what's happening in the money world, the traditional money world. And what's happening in the traditional money world, GDP debt levels have never been higher. You know, we've printed 80% of all the dollars in circulation in the last 5-6 years. We got to $1 trillion in circulation over 220 years. We're now printing $1 trillion every 5 months. You know, so if you take a look at debt levels, you look at inflation, you look at money printing, you look at debasement, then you start understanding the value proposition of a hard asset like gold or like Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, I mean, it's digital gold, right? It's not physical gold, but that's the contrast. So every year that you're going to speak to me, absolutely, it's going to go up in fiat terms. So right now, Bitcoin's hovering around $120,000 to $125,000. Last year, I think when we spoke, it was sitting between $60,000 and $70,000. It will keep doing that in money terms. Why? It's not because, but it's not really the Bitcoin story. It's really everything else that gets measured through the Bitcoin lens, i.e. people say, my groceries are getting more expensive. No, your money's getting weaker. So in Bitcoin terms, if you take a look at your home, like my home has gone up in price, sure. But if I take a look at monetarily through money terms, the buying power of that money growth has actually weakened. But if I look at it, when I put my Bitcoin lens on and I look at my home, 4 years ago, my home was a couple thousand Bitcoins. You know, 3 years ago, it was a couple hundred Bitcoins. Today, my house is worth 2 to 3 Bitcoins. Every year when you're in Bitcoin land, things get cheaper. When you're in fiat land, everything keeps climbing in price because of debasement, because of money printing.
This is where the unthinkable happened. They just came here and took his car.
No. I sold it to them. What's this?
It's crime scene tape. Did they pay you at least?
Within 15 minutes, money was in my account.
Were you happy with the number they brought you?
I got almost the same price as what I paid for the car. Everything was easy, everything was painless.
Well, there you have it, South Africa. With We Buy Cars, you won't come short. I'll tell you really.
1.93.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
The Joburg Indaba 2025 is in full swing at the Ananda Club in Sandton, Johannesburg, bringing together the sharpest minds in mining, investment and policy for 2 days of unfiltered dialogue and strategic insight. The Joburg Indaba is where the spin stops and the real talk begins. So says Alec Hogg, the founder of BizNews, who's on the ground and shared his insights from day one.
The man of the moment, as far as mining is concerned, Duncan Oneblood, is the chief executive of Anglo. They've just done this huge deal with the Canadian group Teck in merging the two together. And there were some pretty good questions asked to him today about how this is going to affect Anglo's relationship with South Africa. Remember, it's more than 100 years old. It's really deep roots in South Africa. Now it's moving its head office to Vancouver. But it was interesting to hear that he says, get your regulation right, and South Africa is going to be a boom mining province. And this is a theme that's been coming through consistently. South Africa really has the minerals. In fact, it's one of the most underexplored for the moment mining operations regions in the world. But because our regulations and policy is so bad, everyone's been staying away. So all they're saying is, please try and get this right. The money will flood in. Jobs will increase. And that's been a very, very strong theme. But even so, even without that, we mustn't forget mining contributes 43% of South Africa's exports and 14% of our GDP.
As you heard from Alex, South Africa's mining sector is grappling with the implications of the Draft Mineral Resources Development Bill of 2025. And industry leaders are voicing deep concern over the regulatory uncertainty it introduces. Among the most vocal is Neil Pretoria, CEO of DRD Gold, who warns that the proposed changes could in fact destabilize investment and operational confidence in the sector. Pretoria says the lack of clarity and consistency in the bill's provisions, particularly around ownership changes, beneficiation mandates, and ministerial discretion, are concerning. The amendments propose sweeping changes, including stricter controls on mine ownership, transfers, mandatory local beneficiation, and new licensing requirements for mine dumps. While the government claims the bill will streamline processes and promote inclusive growth, Pretorius and other industry leaders argue it could in fact choke investment, especially in junior and mid-tier mining operations.
The ministry is having to also advance a particular ideology, and it's committed to that ideology. And sometimes one gets the impression that that ideology might mean a little bit more to them than the industry itself. I don't think it will necessarily become more enabling. What we are seeing, though, is that we're not having the door closed in our faces. So with this recent bill that's now the amendment bill, it was unfortunately it was released without first sharing it with the industry. It sort of came out of, and then that's almost like it was driven sort of the way that you drive wage negotiations. You know, you walk into the first round of negotiations and the unions come up with this very ambitious set of demands, and then the understanding is that it gets whittled away and that common ground. Maybe this was approached like wage negotiations typically get approached in South Africa, but it's unfortunate that we weren't consulted beforehand, because we're not negotiating wages. We're negotiating the future of the industry and the attractiveness of this industry, also from a capital investment perspective. But the door's not being closed in our face, and we are definitely being given a platform for constructive engagement. I think the members of the Minerals Council, because we're driving the Sol initiative through them, they've taken the view that if we provide perspective, then perhaps we can convince the ministry to temper some of the provisions, and that we can achieve some of the outcomes that they seemingly hold dear without necessarily bringing this degree of uncertainty or harm to the industry. So we are engaging constructively with the ministry and pointing out what some of the potentially unintended consequences might be of this route that they're taking.
Switching gears to international news, Tesla plans to unveil a cheaper version of the Model Y, following through on its plans to offer a more affordable car after the loss of US incentives for electric vehicles. Our colleagues at Bloomberg have all the details.
One of the more colorful moments on that call was, some of the other executives at the company kind of dancing around these questions about what this more affordable Tesla would be, and Musk just coming right out and saying, let's let the cat out of the bag. It's just a Model Y. I think the expectation here, of course, is that this by taking some of the content out of the vehicle, making it a little bit less attractive from a range perspective, but more attractive from a price perspective. The hope here is that some incremental consumers who maybe were going to be priced out of this vehicle now can maybe afford it with this $7,500 tax credit going away. And I think that's going to be, one of the key questions for the next earnings call from Tesla is, just how steep of a cliff are we looking at here now that incentive has been sort of pulled out from under the industry.
I can see that reacts to the unwinding of the tax credit. But there's been this ongoing call for them to offer a less costly version of the EV, largely because of China competition. Is it enough?
I think, that's a really fair question. And Ed's reported on this going back quite a while that, Elon Musk is not particularly interested in expanding the lineup with an altogether new vehicle when in his mind, this is a company that's on the cusp of making vehicles capable of driving themselves. And so, why bother with introducing a more affordable vehicle and right. competing with the likes of a Corolla or a Civic when, what you have in the lineup is on the cusp of doing something that, no other manufacturer is going to be capable of doing. The question, of course, is can he make good on that sort of, promise or vision?
Bridgewater Associates founder Ray Dalio says gold should make up about 15% of investment portfolios. He says the metal is an excellent portfolio diversifier. He speaks to Bloomberg's Lisa Abramovich at the Greenwich Economic Forum.
When you're thinking, you're doing your asset allocation, what is going to protect your real after-tax returns so you create that optimal mix? Gold is a very excellent diversifier of the portfolio. So if you were to look at just from the strategic asset allocation mix perspective, you would probably have something like, as the optimal mix, something like 15% of your portfolio in gold because of the fact that if you didn't even have a tactical, because it is the one asset that does very well when the typical parts of your portfolio go down, because the typical parts of your portfolio are also so credit dependent. So anyway, I think all of this means that there should be some piece in that of gold. If I'm making tactical bets, I don't like debt assets per se. And I would say I don't like debt assets per se, not just government debt assets, but also if you're looking, let's say, at credit or private credit and you look at where the credit spreads are very, very low. And so for those various reasons, my tilts would be away from those things.
And toward gold.
But again, yes, so more than would be a normal asset allocation mix. But I think you have to also say, start with what is a real dollar, if you're a dollar investor, a real return asset that you're going to hold as part of that portfolio. The most of the system is dependent on credit. Equities and everything is dependent on credit. You change credit and, then all sorts of things happen. And so it's an effective diversifier as well as probably the timing seems good.
And Trump threatens no pay for furloughed workers. President Trump opened the door to blocking back pay for certain federal workers when the government does indeed reopen, a move that would heighten legal scrutiny of the administration's maneuvers during the shutdown. Bloomberg's Derek Warbank speaks to The China Show.
We're
right where we were. I wish I could tell you that it was something different and that there had been some big, coming together of minds, but there just hasn't. Congress is still stuck where it has been over this issue of healthcare subsidy money. We are seeing a couple of cracks in the dam, a little bit on both sides. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the very, very hawkish right winger from Georgia, was probably the biggest one so far, said her kids, her adult children, have plans that their costs would double if this isn't done, and criticized Republican leaders for, in her words, not having a plan to deal with, or not having communicated a plan to deal with this. But overall, we're still in the situation where the president is ratcheting up threats for pain on Democrats, suggesting that he may be able to withhold pay from federal workers. There is a substantial amount of question about whether or not that's something he can actually do. But that is the threat that's there. And hanging over all of this is a threat from Russ Vogt, the OMB director, to maybe, rather than furlough federal workers, which they are currently furloughed, to actually go through with permanent job cuts, trying to put pressure on Democrats. As is, we're waiting right now ahead of a key pressure point, I would say, of next week, when you really start seeing a lot of federal workers, particularly members of the military, may miss paychecks if this drags on long enough. We've also seen across the United States tonight, my time, some hitches in air traffic control with some staffing issues related to the shutdown.
And that brings us to the end of this BizNews briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with more context on the local and global front. Thanks, as always, for joining us.